And welcome to Unreal Bluegrass. I'm Steve Martin, your host. In this hour, we're going to talk to John McEwen about his brand new book, 50th Anniversary, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? The Making of a Landmark Album. And it is an absolute landmark album. 50 years blows my mind. It's been 50 years. I hope you've had a chance to enjoy that. There have been a second and a third compilation. I think the first one was the real sea change that opened the doors for so many musicians and so many different forms of music, and maybe the beginning of what we might now call Americana. I don't know really what it was. And my quote inside the book makes that very point, that I couldn't tell what it was, pop or rock or what it was, or country, but it certainly changed the landscape. In the book and in our discussion, we talk about this moment. In the book, there's a photograph of John McEwen with Earl Scruggs. And it's the greatest photograph. It's John is just leaning back with his feet up, and he's playing clawhammer banjo. And Earl, who is everybody's idol that's ever touched a banjo, is playing Soldier's Joy. We're going to play that tune cut first, and then we're going to get into the wonderful discussion with my friend John McEwen. Thanks, John, again for your availability and your generosity and the great contributions that you've made to American music. Very happy to have back on Unreal Bluegrass one of my favorite guests, one of my very good friends out there in the music world, John McEwen. John, it's so nice to hear from you again.
I am? Well, thank you. It's nice to hear.
John is John's a regular guest. He is one of the few people that has an open invitation to Unreal Bluegrass whenever, wherever, however. John wants to talk to me so that we can have a show. I'm open for it. I'm open for it. But the occasion today, not only just it's been a while since we chatted for public consumption, but this wonderful book, the 50th anniversary, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? The Making of a Landmark Album. Wow.
Yeah.
That's all I can say is wow. I've just... there's
you so read many, the book?
Oh, well, sure. I've read it. I've read it backwards and forwards, actually.
Oh, well, good. Isn't it like... it's if you read that and you play the album, it really takes you there.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it's like you're in the studio. My brother took photo. My brother produced the album, Bill McEwen, and he also shot photos of the early Dirt Band and the Circle sessions. He was the manager and the producer of the Dirt Band. And this book, I put it together to honor his photography and tell the story.
There are stories, unbelievably, there are stories that I've never known. Of course, I know there's a lot of them that I don't know, even as much as I've had, as much as we chatted about things, and they generally come back around to the Circle album at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what Chrome Coat. I didn't know. I read three or four people that talk about the album, and what we're talking about is a book that is based on some stories from the recording of the original Will the Circle Be Unbroken, maybe the greatest country album, as they called it back then, ever, with more photographs, as John mentioned, from his brother Bill. And then there's a little story that goes on.
150 photographs.
Wow.
And it's really cool. It's a thick book. The pictures are big, too. They aren't like an inch by an inch.
No, no.
CD or album.
There's a wonderful photograph of you and Earl where you're kind of kicked back. And
yeah.
You're sitting there playing banjo with Earl, and you have to have felt, John, that even though it was happening, you have to, in the back of your mind, keep thinking, while you're doing that, as nice of a man as Earl was, as you read through this, you realize how accommodating he was to this effort. You had to be sitting there thinking, is this really happening?
Well, Earl had a way of taking that kind of intimidation or whatever away from you, and you concentrated on the music. I thought about, did this just happen after it happened?
Yeah, okay.
But while we were playing, it was like really cool. And I was really respectful. I was the first banjo player that I know of to record with Earl Scruggs, and that was kind of a responsibility
I never thought about that. That makes sense to me that you had been, because it's not like he did a lot of things with other banjo players. He didn't need to. I didn't think about that. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think you probably were.
And trailing Soldier's Joy to his picking it, with the bass player playing along.
Yeah.
That was like one of my lifelong dreams when I first started playing. I wanted to record Soldier's Joy with Earl Scruggs someday. I'd have to meet him first.
There are photographs in here. I didn't know the story of Tut Taylor. Tut Taylor calls himself the only flat pick dobro player. And I didn't know that he had come in for just a brief moment and then just left, didn't participate in the recording any further. But those are things that I'm not trying to give away the whole story, but there's things in here that I don't know. And John and I have talked about this album a lot over the years in conjunction with other things that John's been pleading, including The Life I Picked, which was a book that you wrote in 2013.
Uh-huh.
By the way, John's a great writer. I said this before to you, John, that just for storytelling, John's a great storyteller. Even if we take it out of this context, John McEwen.
You. Oh, you're welcome.
John's a great storyteller, a great writer. It's enjoyable to read if you just want to read. But I didn't know that little story. I had no idea about the album cover itself is a work of art and nominated for all sorts of awards. But I had no idea, thinking back in time, what the chrome coat, can you mention a little bit about what that is? There's several references to the album cover itself. And how
well, I thought people should know more about the record since they were always talking about the cover. And they were talking about the quality of the recording, so I explained what the recording on two-track really meant, what it meant to the overall recording, about groove push, inner diameter distortion, and things that people don't make themselves aware of because they never hear about it. Just in short, if a song is the first song on the outside of a record, the number one cut, it might be 100 feet long. And if you make that cut number 5 towards the middle, the same song will only be 75 feet long. And it's on a tighter turn. You know, that turn gets tighter as you go towards the center.
Yeah.
And it makes a problem for the needle where it's riding. And anyway, I explain it more in the book.
Right.
But it's the kind of thing where you're cramming more information if it's an inside cut. So you don't put the loudest piece of music on that last song. Because you have to master at an even level so people don't have to turn their stereos up and down. They want to be able to play the record and leave the volume. And you put the louder songs in the middle or on the first early. And anyway, it's something people often don't think about.
They don't think about. And I've never seen photographs that go along with the process. And inside the book, you have photographs of...
My brother documented everything. Yeah. The making of the cover, the chrome coat board you mentioned.
Yeah. I've never heard of that term before.
Well, it's just what the printers call it. It's the board that's shiny on one side, and they make perfume boxes out of it, and that's what Bill wanted to make the cover out of.
Oh, okay, all right, I understand. Now, when you said that, I remember the album. I have the original album, but when you mentioned that, it was, okay, I get it now, the chrome coat now, okay.
And when you print on it, the black really comes out black, and the colors really pop, and they needed to for this album. And explanation of the process of making the cover is... I wanted to explain that, and along with explaining, telling the story of the early Dirt Band pictures, that was really fun, the jug band that struggled through 4 albums till they made the 5th album, which was Uncle Charlie, which had the hits Some of Shelley's Blues, House of Pooh Corner, and Mr. Bojangles, which became the album that Earl heard.
Yeah, I see.
His son Gary played it for him, and... Earl said, after he heard Randy Lynn Rag, he said, let's go see that band. And we were playing at Vanderbilt a month later, and they did. The whole family came.
Did you know they were there at the time?
I went over early because I was in Nashville, and I'd seen Earl with Flatten Scruggs in 1965. My brother and I made our way to Nashville. We couldn't get in. It was sold out. But I heard the back windows were open on the north side of the building, because it was a hot August night. And I went back there, and right when I looked in the window, Lester Flatt goes up to the mic and says, Earl and I are going to bring out Mama Maybelle Carter to do the Wildwood Flower. And the place went nuts. It was just absolutely crazy. And she came out and played Wildwood Flower. And I said to my brother, I got to record with those people someday, but I didn't know them.
It took a while to get them to the. It's interesting, the story. And again, inside the book, and this we're talking. I'm talking to John McEwen about the Will the Circle Be Unbroken 50th anniversary. The whole title I'm going to tell him: The Making of a Landmark Album. And it has photographs never released before by your brother Bill, and stories that come with the process. That, as I've said before, I've read The Life I Picked, which I think you wrote in 2013, at least when it was released. And I've talked to you enough, John, to know stories, but there are things in here that we don't need to talk about because they're in the book and people will. But there are things in this book that I never knew. I never knew what was going on. And you see the photographs with it, and you think, you had no idea this stuff was happening.
Well, I was trying to get Josh Graves to play Dobro on the Circle album.
Yeah.
You know, Josh was Flattin' Scruggs, and Josh, that sounds like a good idea. Let me call you back. I got to ask Lester. And he called back a week later and said, Lester says as long as I'm on his payroll, he doesn't want me picking with that role. And
I thought
people should know that. Wow. So that's why Tut Taylor was temporarily tried out. But Tut Taylor was a Dobro player that we'd heard from L.A.
Sure.
Bill and I had admired him. Well, but it was like, we could do. We got to do. Well, that's when we got Norman Blake.
Well, and Tut, for my memory, John, all the old John Hartford things. He did a lot later, I guess. Then later was with the airplane and things like that, and the steam powered airplane. I think that was Tut involved in a lot of those recordings with John.
Yeah,
but different style of playing. But and I did not know. I'm not trying to give away all these secrets. Please don't let me do this, because people need to buy this book and read it. But
if they contact Landmark Booksellers,
yeah,
because booksellers, one word,
yeah,
Landmark Booksellers in Franklin, Tennessee, they can either get an autographed copy, autographed by the whole band.
Wow.
Or, which was very difficult to get done by mailing stuff around the country. And anyway, autographed by the whole band, or they can just buy the books that I sign alone. But it's Landmark Booksellers, Franklin, Tennessee.
I hope that everybody would buy it that has the original album, because it's just so nice, like you said, as you read it and if you can play it and listen to these things, you have the dialogue that we all hear. This wonderful thing of letting the tape run throughout the recording process. And some of the dialogue you have print, I won't tell everybody what it is, but some of my favorite dialogue in the back of these is printed along with photographs of the participants of just discussions going on during the recording process. It was that informal.
Yeah, that was by a separate tape machine that was running at 3 3/4 inches per second. I got to change that reel every hour or so. And it was running to catch all the open mics were running into it, and Bill used that to capture the dialogue and before and after songs, like Maybelle and Doc Watson talking about where Doc says, Maybelle, you know the ending you put on that old song? And she goes, well, on the old record, I started it like this, and she starts Keep on the Sunny Side. Well, those were quite a ways apart, actually, in reality, but they were put next to each other on the editing. Bill had quite an editing job when we finished recording this album. 5 days, we did 36 songs. And one of the things I think is interesting, Steve, is that there's the session sheet for one of the session days.
Right.
It's got like 10 songs on it.
Right. that's one of the
things. And what's funny about that is those are 10 finished songs. They weren't basic tracks. It was the track. It was the master.
Mm. There are pictures of, and we don't have to tell all the stories, but there's pictures of Doc Watson and Merle. Travis, in one of your albums later, you do a live album where you talk about a story that you relate in this book, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? You actually tell the story in one of your live albums when you're talking about getting Merle onto the project, and you retell. I love that. What's the name of that album? It's L.A.
Round Trip.
Yeah. I love the story, and that's another thing that I drop into the playlist every once in a while, because it's
thank you.
Oh, it's John McEwen. He's talking about going to Merle's interested in doing this, and you go there, and it's an hysterical story. You recount that in the book, and I can let people read that, but they can listen to it every once in a while.
There's a lot of people that haven't heard the Round Trip album.
No. Well, I mean, it's stories like that with pictures. Some of these stories I knew, John, but seeing the photographs, I can now see Jimmy Martin. And, you know, Jimmy Martin had a very distinctive style and a way of making his appearance on the vocal tracks that were running all the time. I can now see Jimmy and the stories that Jimmy would tell, and you can see the conversation between Doc, we'll say on this one, without getting into it, between Doc and Merle. Oddly enough, John, you tell the story about this. You have before, first time they ever met.
First time
Doc ever met
Doc
Merle.
Merle
yeah.
Met.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's that was captured by the constantly running tape. And I had to stop Merle. Doc Watson's good. They started talking, and my brother was in the control room. He was waving at me, get a mic in front of Travis. Get a mic, excuse me, Merle, can you move over for a minute? He didn't know what I was doing, but they found out later.
That wonderful bit of dialogue is printed out in here, and I'm not going to tell the whole story of it, but it's one of my favorites. And it's photographs, it's stories, and there's bits of dialogue that go on that continuing vocal track that you've actually typed out so people can read it. And in my mind, when I read those bits, I hear the voices right away that go with it because I heard the album so many times. I was thinking,
that's
you can hear it right away.
No good. I tried to lay this out so it would be like you're at the sessions and experiencing some of what went on with us. And I think it works out.
There are great photographs of Vassal Clements. So I read from this that you weren't, as a band, or you weren't that well experienced with Vassal Clements, right? That you weren't too familiar with Vassal Clements prior to this.
I'd never heard of them because they didn't do album credits. I asked Earl, I said, have you found some fiddle players to handle the different styles? And Earl said, well, I found one man. His name's Vassal Clements. And I said, well, can he handle it all? And Earl just said, he'll do. And then after I hung up from that call, I realized, I went and found out that Vassar was on Bill Monroe record that I loved, and Jimmy Martin, and Jim and Jesse, and he was, I thought there was a bunch of hot fiddlers out there that played like him, played like that, but it was all him. The Circle album, I asked Vassar, hey Vassar, how do you play Uncle Penn? And he played it, and he finished the solo, and I said, wow, that sounds just like an old Bill Monroe record. You went off that. John, it was me on that record. I was 17 years old.
I don't think anybody played like Vassar Clements. And we're getting off track here a little bit, but there's a lot of material in the book and a lot of photographs of Vassar from that session and how he comes into the project. But thinking back, I don't think that anybody would have naturally become the player that Vassar became. I think he was very unique and weirdly, incredibly talented, but I think his sound was real different. His approach to things was not like anybody
else.
From
another planet.
Yeah, that's the best way to describe it.
He didn't read chord charts. He couldn't read music. He was just different. We actually ran through Keep on the Sunny Side like two times because we had to get the solos straightened out and stuff, and Maybell said the second time, Vassar Clements, could you quit all that fooling around and just play the melody? yes, Mama, sorry.
I get the feeling that, and you can see from the photographs that that are in this book, that when she's, not say on stage, but when she's there performing, everybody kind of is taking, they're not staring at her, but everybody's paying attention to her as she's playing. And if there are photographs where she's visible, you can tell she's sort of facing the camera and all the other people are looking at her, basically.
I didn't notice that.
Look at that. And that's what I get the feeling, never knew her, never saw her. I mean, I know of her music, but I get the feeling she was very, very quiet, very soft-spoken, but I felt like she played and everybody's attention went to her, and she knew that
she
would happen.
She was very precise when she played.
Yeah, so. like a machine with a heart, I guess, is the only way you can describe it.
You know, that's a good way to put it. She really, and she tuned everything a step flat. So when she played song in D. It was actually C. And
now, why
on her
would,
guitar.
Why would she just fit her voice better, or what would be the point of
I
that?
I think it worked her voice better, and then she thought the guitar sounded better.
Okay.
And that's why she said on the record, if I do Wildwood Flower on the auto harp, I'll play it in F natural. She didn't tune the auto harp down. And she asked
on the record, can I play it? Do you care? It's kind of like, do you care if I play it this way? Do whatever you want to do, however you want to do it, whatever you want to play it in. It's like, you know, that's the song that you made, you know?
Maybell, you're asking us if we will play your song. Tell us, please.
That's the best way to describe it. There's also a bit in here, and photographs, again, and there's photographs of Earl and Jimmy and Merle and all these great things that are right there as it's happening. And there's a little bit in there about talking about Mother Maybelle and Earl's, the secret that Earl had about playing guitar to match those tunes that Mother Maybelle was playing. And I never realized.
Yeah, he really admired her playing. It was something he tried to do. Well, he did it quite well.
Yeah.
And had that certain Appalachian sound when he played guitar. It was wonderful.
It's great, isn't it? That, and you got to sit there. You got to play. Well, did you play banjo when he was doing some of that guitar work?
Yeah, I played on a couple of his guitars. Yeah. The songs he played guitar, I played banjo.
And
that was really cool.
Well, here's the guy who really broke the world into this style of playing, the syncopated style. And so all of a sudden, I don't know that people always realized what an incredible guitar player he was in that fashion, that he was just as precise and perfect in timing and everything when he played guitar in the style that we're talking about.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He was really, he said that Maybelle's style gave me a lot of ideas for my banjo playing. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. So what would that mean then? That is the timing. Is it the phrasing? Is it the notes? I know that Earl really wanted to stay on to the melody, or if there were lyrics, he wanted to stay on to the lyric.
I think it was the timing and where you put the melody with the with the playing.
Okay.
It was, I don't know. Maybe it's a secret.
Well, there's a whole chapter about the secret. We won't give that away. You know, one of my favorite photographs in here, John, I know I've seen it before, and it's a picture with Doug Dillard and you and Ramblin' Jack, and there's something that photograph. It's an old black and white. I know it's not from this session. It's just something. In the early part of the book, you're talking about the Dirt Band and then leading into this project and how it happened. It was a great story, but that's one of my favorite photographs because of the look on your face. Doug Dillard is there. And Ramblin' Jack, that photograph to me is just as joy as the music as it's coming. I just think it's one of the nicest photographs.
That's a real treasure to me, too, because Doug Dillard was there and he played with me. The reason I started playing the banjo was Doug Dillard. And Ramblin' Jack Elliott was, at that time I was starting to play, was just the mystery man, Ramblin' Jack, you know? And he's out there rambling around.
Right.
I wonder what he is really like. Is he really? And, you know, years later, here we are in Aspen. I see Jack walking down Highway 82, and I pick him up. Hey, Jack, you need a ride into town? He gets in the truck. I hadn't seen him for a couple of years. And he just starts talking. Yeah, she took my dog too. Can you believe it? The woman kicked me out of the house.
She took
my
dog. That's down. That's pretty low down. That's a long, lonesome road he was on there before you picked him up.
Yeah, he was a fun guy.
Oh, I love that photograph. And you mentioned Doug Dillard and the Dillards, of course, and they somehow. I talked to Rodney about this at length. Somehow they made that jump from the middle of the country to the West Coast, and they had such a great impact on that part of the world at a time when bluegrass really wasn't, you know, they were playing the huge college crowds when nobody was, and they were mixing that folk sound into the bluegrass sound, and Doug was such a distinctive, crisp player.
Never made a mistake. He was incredible, and they drove to L.A. in a station wagon. They stopped in Oklahoma City to get jobs so they could get enough money to buy gas. And they made it to L.A. and they got a job at the Ash Grove, which is now the Improv. And in that first week, they're playing the Ash Grove, and the record company guy, oh, what's his name? Darn it, I can't think of it right now. A record company guy says, you guys want to make an album? They make an album. Andy Griffith hears it. He goes to see him. A couple of weeks later, they're on the Andy Griffith show. I mean, it all just happened.
It was the weirdest.
Hey, let's go out in L.A. and get on a record and make an album and get on TV and play some clubs.
Yeah.
And, boy, they played every club in L.A. Usually a week or two at a time.
And, boy, they were doing things nobody was doing back then. Not in club. I mean, I think there were people doing it. But what was the first album? Back me up here for a second. What was the first album that they recorded? Was that the
Back Porch Bluegrass?
That's it. Yeah, I have that. I bought that for 99 cents at Penny's. Okay, back in the day when you could shop that. Backstreet. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, that was there wasn't a mistake on that album.
Boy, it's just it cracked.
I listened for years, and there's got to be a banjo mistake on here. Because the engineer that did that album is the same engineer my brother flew out to Nashville, Dino Lapis, to engineer the Circle album.
Oh.
And I put that in the book also, that Dino had worked on a lot of records for Liberty Records. He recorded everybody from the Ventures to Bobby V and the Jazz Crusaders, and he did the Dillard's albums. And so it was nice to have him along. He also recorded Dirt Band albums.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I did read that snippet of it. And again, I don't want to tell everything away. It's a great book, John. Thank you so much for putting this together and making the effort. I know you took a long time to get it.
Yeah, I spent about 2.5 years putting this together.
That's what I thought, because I know that we talked about this process a long time ago. And you something you had as a goal to do, and I thought, well, what a wonderful idea, and I was so glad it finally came out in such a wonderful, wonderful book that it is.
I got slowed down a little bit. My brother died in the middle of it.
Yeah.
He gave me the photos years ago, and I wanted to put the book together, and I was putting it together, and all of a sudden, I don't have him to show it to.
Yeah.
But so I had to let a few months go by and then get back into it. But I'm proud of it. And the writing, it's 80% I did the writing, but then I enlisted each of the Dirt Band guys that were there, Jimmy Ibbotson, Jeff Hanna, Jimmy Fadden, and Les Thompson, to write their impressions of making the album.
Yeah.
And they each wrote a completely different type of thing. And I got some other people, like Marty Stewart wrote a wonderful piece. Gary Scruggs wrote his viewpoint on what happened. And then some other people, like Lance Smith, an agent that booked the Dirt Band. And I introduced Lance to Earl, and he booked Earl for several years as the Earl Scruggs Review. And there's some other people involved. But I think one of the proudest things is the opening comment is by Rita Forrester. That's A.P. Carter's granddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she's about 80 years old or so. And I asked Rita if she'd, Rita, would you write something for this? And she goes, "Why, honey, I'd be proud to you. Now, I just hope I can write it good enough." And she knocked out a really nice street piece.
Nice. There's all those great perspectives. You also have a perspective, which is not just because he's a friend of yours from high school in a long time. There's a perspective from Steve Martin, because wasn't he there in the studio and then also using the studio around the same time, maybe at nighttime, to record the Steve Martin Brothers, one of his albums? Wasn't he there?
My brother told Steve he should come to Nashville, and I told Steve, "I'll introduce you to Earl Scruggs if you do." And he came to Nashville. I introduced him to Earl. There's a photo of him.
There is a great photo, yeah.
And in a hotel room. And when the sessions were done, Bill kept Steve behind to record some of his music with Vassar and Junior and a couple other players.
Yeah.
And ended up on the Steve Martin Brothers.
Yeah, the Steve Martin Brothers, yeah. Yeah, there's a nice section from him, and it's not just there because of who he is. He was actually there at the time. He was participating in another project. But then Bill, your brother Bill,
he was there to be around the Circle album and record some of his music.
That's right.
He wasn't the Steve Martin yet.
No, not yet. He was just
Steve, a guy that played the banjo and was trying to get a job being funny.
That's right. So, but your brother Bill, didn't he produce not only the first album or two that Steve did when he was coming back to doing, and we're talking about Bill McEwen. I'm talking to John McEwen about the book, about the Will the Circle Be Unbroken. We're kind of going a little bit of sidetrack. But your brother Bill produced an album or two that Steve did that did pretty well. And then didn't he also produce or be involved in the movie?
Bill managed Steve. He got him a record deal. He produced four albums with him and four or five movies.
Yeah.
The Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Jerk.
The Jerk, yeah.
That one about Man with Two Brains. Pennies from Heaven, which was a stiff. But
That was a different one.
And one other one. I think five movies he did. And he produced four albums. He produced King Tut, too.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
In one day, we recorded King Tut. And one day to record it and mix it and be done. And it was really neat.
Well, you talk about really neat. I enjoy everything that you uncover about the recording session in the Circle. I enjoy your discussions of the Dirt Band. I will also say, too, that if people should get this book, which they should, if they have the album, if they don't, they should have the album. You used to have a sticker on it, John. I told you this before. When it came out, when the Circle album came out, it was in plastic wrap, and it had a circle on it that said, the only country album you ever need, or something like that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and locally I saw that a couple little orange sticker on there. This is like the only one. I thought, well, you look at the album.
Well, not only if you contact Landmark Booksellers in Franklin, Tennessee, that's Landmark Booksellers.
Yes.
And it worked out that local store by where I live had the name Landmark in front of it, and this is called a Landmark album. Landmark album, and so that worked out really well. Well, they have the copies that are autographed by all the band members, and also they have a situation where you can pick up an LP for I think $40 or $50 additional, and they're usually about $60 in the store.
Wow.
But that's a vinyl LP that has a big poster and liner notes and some extra photos and four extra songs. Wait a minute. Sorry, the four extra songs are on the CD. I couldn't fit them on the LP.
No.
I remastered the LP, but you can only put 18 minutes on a side.
It's 50 years, John. It's hard to imagine that 50 years since that original, the way the thing is described and how it just came together and all these perfect moments came together to make the Circle Be Unbroken album. And here it is, 50th anniversary.
Well, I asked Earl Scruggs if he records, and the next week I asked Doc. 8 weeks later, we started recording. 5 days later, we were done.
it's magic. I think it's magic. I'm not exaggerating. I think it's magic, the album. I think the book that describes what happened and the photographs are just put you right there inside the studio. It's a wonderful thing, John. I know you're so busy. Every time I see you on some social media, you're performing, you're getting together with groups. I so much appreciate your time to be on Unreal Bluegrass. I really cherish the moments that we get to talk about.
Well, I appreciate yours, Steve. It's wonderful.
You're welcome.
Thank you for all the time you've given me.
Well, anytime.
I just want people to know about this book, that they can get it mailed to them in time for a Christmas present.
Heck yeah. What a great thing. Gosh, it's already we're past the mid part of November. Yes, a wonderful Christmas gift. I didn't think about that. You're right.
I've been thinking about that for 6 months.
That would have more part to do with the timing. Do we get it in this year for the holiday seasons, or can we wait? That's great. John McEwen, man, I enjoy you all the time. Thanks so much for being part of this program on a regular basis. And
you want to play a cut from the album?
We can do that. Yeah, tell me which one. We'll drop it in as I say goodbye to you. And
let's play a Vassar Clement song, the Lonesome Fiddle Blues.
Okay, we'll do that. I'll go ahead. Describe.
This is one where I was learning the notes from Basser. He's out teaching me. I'm trying to play it in G tuning, but it's in the key of D minor. And so I wanted to do that because nobody had done that before. And thought, this will be cool. And how much time do I have before we do Lonesome Fiddle Blues, Bill? He goes, oh, probably an hour or two. So we're out in the hallway, and he's showing it to me. And 5 minutes later, he comes out. We got to do Lonesome Fiddle Blues now. No, I'm not ready. And anyway, well, I got through it.
Well, you did. You did.
Amazed me.
We'll play that for the audience when I let you get back to all the things you have going on. And I'll say happy holiday. I don't know that I'll talk to you again before then. But John, thank you so much, and happy holidays. And we'll catch up again later on down the road, as they say. And
Well, happy holidays to you.
You too.
And thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And as the, you have to say, what's the goodbye line that you always use? Thanks for having me.
Like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.
There you go. It wouldn't be the same without that. All right, John, thanks so much. I appreciate you so much.
Landmark Booksellers, yeah. Franklin, Tennessee.
I think you made your point very well.
All right,
John, we'll drop that tune in for you. Take care.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
Bye-bye.